But I feel like when you're really emotionally connected to this project and it was truly an emergency, I think it really pushes you to do what you think is impossible.
Hello and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. On the show, I interview peak performing innovators in the creative, social impact, and earth conservation spaces who are working to change the world. This episode is brought to you by Brain FM. Brain FM combines the best of music and neuroscience to help you relax, focus, meditate, and even sleep. I love it and have been using it to write, create, and do some of my deepest work. Because you're a listener of the show, you can get a free trial. Head over to brain.fm/innovativemindset to check it out. If you decide to subscribe, you can get 20% off with the coupon code innovativemindset, all one word. And now, let's get to the show. Hey there, and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. My name is Isolde Trachtenberg. I'm your host, and I'm really happy that you're here. And I'm also thrilled and honored to have this week's guest. And you'll understand why as soon as I tell you a little bit about her. Wendy Hapgood is the co-founder and chief operating officer of Wild Tomorrow Fund, a wildlife conservation charity dedicated to saving threatened and endangered wildlife and their habitats. And that last part is a really important part of what Wendy and her group what they're doing. Wendy believes that biodiversity loss and climate change are the two most critical issues facing our planet today. In 2015, she left Wall Street behind to dedicate her life to the protection of the environment and biodiversity. She's singing my song. She completed her master's degree in sustainability management at Columbia University's Earth Institute, where she studied climate change science and policy, researched the intersection of poverty and rhino poaching, uncovered illegal ivory in New York City, and studied new methods of financing the green economy. Ah, Wendy, I am so honored that you're here. Thank you so much for being here. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Isolde, for having me. I'm really excited to be on your show.
Oh, wow. You're living my dream life in many ways. It's exactly the kind of thing that I have always wanted to do. So I'm so glad that you took it and ran with it and are doing it. I love you. You left Wall Street and you went, that's it. I'm changing my whole life around and I'm doing this now. I'm going to dedicate my life to saving wildlife and saving protected lands. What sparked that for you? What made you go, okay, you know what? I'm making that change. I'm going to totally transform the way I live and I'm going to innovate things on my own terms.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really big jump. And I have to say that this feeling grew within me that sort of it happened over years where I had this sneaking feeling of, you know, unhappiness or just dissatisfaction with life and what I was doing with my life. And I was successful in finance and I did like my job and the people I worked with and customers, but there was something really missing for me, which was a sense of purpose. You know, I absolutely love animals and I feel like probably a lot of your listeners have pets that you just adore and it really starts there and, you know, hiking and just starting to feel that I needed to do something about what I was seeing around me in terms of environmental destruction and climate change. And, you know, people talk about ecological grief, starting to feel really sad about what was happening to the planet and knowing I wasn't helping. A really big moment was I was actually working in Tokyo, Japan, and I was there for the big earthquake, which, you know, resulted in a nuclear crisis. So being on the ground in Tokyo and living there and worrying about if my bath water was contaminated, which by the way it was. Wow. And, you know, it was such a post-apocalyptic scenario that I was living. And what really shocked me was how a lot of people weren't that concerned. They, after it, were like, well, and people from outside of Japan and friends were like, well, no one died, you know, after this nuclear crisis. But whereas I couldn't stop thinking about how we poisoned the earth, you know, it's sort of forever. And that wasn't being spoken about. And it really was a sort of symbolic moment of, and I felt complicit in it as someone living in the city using, you know, that's what all the power being generated for. That's what the nuclear power was needed for. So I felt really complicit in this poisoning of the earth. And I felt very guilty about when I left later that year to come to New York about not being able to help both people that were, you know, refugees, internal refugees from that crisis and thinking about how we poisoned the land. And, you know, I saw it with my own eyes up in Fukushima. So that really was a huge moment in my life of thinking, what can I do and how can I help and stop being a part of the destruction. Then in New York, I met my now husband, John Stewart, who is the other co-founder of Wild Tomorrow Fund. He was in a similar place in life. He was an advertising executive here in New York, a creative director, also loved animals, and was in a place like me wondering what next to do in life and actually make a difference and help animals and nature. So that was nice. I'm not sure I could have done it all on my own. It definitely helps to have a partner and to embark on this big journey together. So that's what we did in 2015. And then personally, I felt like I needed a little more background, and I love studying. So I went and did my master's at Columbia, which was Columbia University, the Earth Institute, gave me, I felt like, a little more confidence and background in sustainability and environmental problems and climate change science and all kinds of really fascinating things. So that helped me on my journey as well to feel ready to really switch careers and focus 100% on saving the planet.
I'm taking that all in. I sometimes take these little pauses because I'm like, I'm overwhelmed. That's amazing. So here you are. You've made the decision, and you came out of with your master's. And I'm so fascinated. What did you do next? How did you decide, you know what, we're going to buy land in South Africa? And what were the steps that you took to make that start happening? I imagine the bureaucracy is monumental.
Well, again, I think we took it step by step. And when John and I started Wild Tomorrow Fund, we also felt like buying land and saving habitat, as much as we knew that that was the, you know, really big overarching issue, in the same way that climate change kind of hangs over everything. Habitat loss also kind of drives so much of the environmental loss and destruction we see today. But that would be a huge thing to start with. So when we started Wild Tomorrow Fund, we started in 2015, really just with small things. We were asking friends, family for $50 to buy boots for rangers, because what we saw on the ground in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa, which is where we're focused, was that government reserves in particular were super under-resourced. You know, they're in charge of protecting incredible biodiversity, some of the last big tusked elephants in the world, really under-resourced, trying to fight the rhino poaching crisis. And, you know, here's these amazing people who are very dedicated, boots on the ground, but they don't have good boots.
Right.
So we're from New York. We're like, well, we can help with that, you know, or like really basic things, like they couldn't go out on patrol if the tires had punctures and of their, you know, for their patrol vehicles, and their budget didn't allow them to purchase more that month, you know. So it was like, well, we can fundraise for that, and we can involve people in New York who would love to, you know, it's very direct impact to say, if you can give us $50 donation, we will personally have our team on the ground buy those boots and deliver them. So that's how we started, nice and small, step by step. And then it was 2017 when the land kind of happened, which I say was a land emergency, where one of our partners on the ground told us about this piece of land that was up for sale, and it had two offers on it from pineapple farmers. And when, you know, these farmers wanted to extend their existing fields of pineapples, and if you could see a picture of it, it's just, you know, that typical monoculture farming that just extends out forever in these endless rows of, you know, sameness. And it's terrible for biodiversity. And, you know, this land that was up for sale had been farmed, you know, cattle and a little bit of pineapples, but it kind of been left to go wild. And it had zebra on it. It had, you know, hippos that would come from the river and at nighttime feed on this land. And we went to see it, and that was it. You know, our hearts were kind of stuck. We were like, we have to do something. We cannot allow this to happen. What they would do is if the pineapple farmers bought it, totally clear it. We mean, two tractors a chain, pull out every single tree, run off the wildlife. I mean, turn it into that just very desert-like monoculture of pineapple, commercial, you know, industrial agriculture. So we were pretty determined to do that. But, you know, imagine it was over $1 million, the price tag. And we'd been asking for $50, $100 donations. But I think those emergencies make you really step up. And we felt that we needed to try. And also we know or knew that there's a lot of wealth in New York City and there's a lot of people who care deeply. And, you know, we knew we just needed to meet the right people and tell the story and kind of bring them along in this journey. And we also met with the landowner. She was an older lady living in the city near Johannesburg. So she didn't live at the farm or anything like that, this land. It was her old family. And we kind of pleaded with her. We said, you know, we're a charity. We don't have $1 million sitting ready to make this deal happen. Can you give us time? You know, this will be your legacy too. So thankfully she agreed and she gave us 5 years to save, to raise all the money to save the land. Actually, that deadline's coming up next May. So we still have a little way to go. But in the meantime, we bought another piece that was at risk just down, just nearby. So, you know, created this corridor vision. You know, in the meantime, we established, we felt it was extremely important that the land was owned in South Africa, not by a US charity. So we set up a Wild Tomorrow Fund South Africa, you know, affiliate. So it's a registered charity in South Africa. So the land is owned, you know, locally. Yeah. So there were a lot of legal steps and meetings and learn a lot of learning along the way. But I feel like when you're really emotionally connected to this project and it was truly an emergency, I think it really pushes you to do what you think is impossible. So we're really proud that we were able to save it and then, you know, start working on restoring it and rewilding it, which is really exciting and super hopeful. And I think it transformed us as an organization too. And that's really now our focus. We still help other rangers in the region and we do buy boots for rangers, but the major focus now is really saving that land, protecting it, restoring it and rewilding it.
Yay. Okay. Wow. I wish I had pom-poms or something so I could be doing a little cheer for everything that you just said. You are absolutely singing my song. I worked for NASA for over 20 years doing earth science and environmental education outreach all over the world. So hearing from you that is your active sort of profession, that it's possible that you can have these, make these inroads and have such an impact on a place that probably a lot of people never think about, which, you know, raising that, elevating the visibility of the need to save habitat in places like South Africa is incredible. And I know people in South Africa who are working to educate people in South Africa about that importance too. And so I'm wondering a little bit about, like you said, you have this relationship with the owner of that land, which is incredible. What other kinds of innovative ways have you made relationships with people and government people in South Africa to make these inroads?
It's a great question because, you know, nothing is ever done alone. It really is teamwork. And something that was really important, and just to give a little more background, you know, this land is in a biodiversity hotspot. It's one of 32 places around the world that's recognized for really high levels of biodiversity. So just this massive array of amazing life from insects to furry things, you know. So it was really important to save this land. It's also right next door to a World Heritage wetland, UNESCO World Heritage Park. Mm. So again, another great reason why this piece of land in particular in this area, it was really important to protect it. Something that was that we really needed kind of local support with was this legal declaration. So turning what was kind of designated as farmland into what is now officially a nature reserve. So we reached out to a local South African NGO called Conservation Outcomes, who are experts in navigating this process. It's an amazing initiative under the South African government where they recognize that the state national parks can't do it alone. They need private landowners. You know, it could could be farmers who want to protect a small piece of their land that has an endangered frog. You know, they want to empower private landowners to also contribute to conservation. Mm-hmm. So they have this framework called the Biodiversity Stewardship Program. And we worked with Conservation Outcomes to kind of navigate that whole process, and an amazing environmental attorney who is in Durban who helped us with that. And what's really, I think, amazing about our project and what makes it stand out is it's truly collaborative. So, I mean, we had donors from a lot from New York, some on the West Coast, in other countries give $20 towards this dream, or, you know, $1,000 or $50,000. So it's been, you know, literally thousands of people who've made it possible to save this habitat. And then on the ground, we partnered as well with landowners who were right, like kind of next door to us, or literally sort of inside the borders where they had a little small 20 hectare piece. So, you know, to really expand habitat, it means this term, you know, dropping fences. Imagine in South Africa, land, I guess like suburbia in America, it's all fenced. Mm. So just bigger squares. And so for wildlife to have a better chance at fighting back against extinction, you know, you need to really open up that habitat and save the wild space and extend the wild spaces. So we worked with our neighbors and kind of brought them along in this journey of creating a nature reserve. So this, it's a collective reserve. The land that Wild Tomorrow Fund saved is two separate pieces, and it's about 83% of the total. And then we have three other private landowners who, you know, they have the conservation vision too. They were excited about being a part of it and dropping their fences and opening up their land to also be habitat for wildlife. So, you know, that was a really collective project, and we worked through this legal process, and that was declared last month, which is super exciting. So amazing. The land is officially a nature reserve now in South Africa.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. And I first of all, wow, again. And second of all, you said some things that I am super curious about. Mm-hmm. You said you were talking about breaking the fences and removing them so that wildlife can. And I know I've heard the same thing with like unbroken canopy cover for certain birds,
right?
That they need, you know, that tree canopy cover in order to feel like this is their habitat. Mm. What are the species that are either most impacted or the ones that are in that now nature preserve, which I think is incredible, mm-hmm. that are going to benefit the most from those kinds of fenceless areas?
Well, I would say all wildlife benefits from having more space. We're a huge fan of E.O. Wilson, who is a very famous American biologist, and his book is called Half Earth. And he did all the science. He did all the math for us. But basically, if we want to save 80% of life on Earth, you know, 80% of species on Earth today, we have to kind of protect 50% of land and marine spaces for wildlife. Mm-hmm. You know, if we don't do that, if we can't get to 50%, we can't save species. You know, we can't save 80% of species on Earth. Basically, wildlife and animals need, especially the longer ranging ones, so the ones that really need space are the big megafauna. So elephants, lions, leopards, hyena, you know, the ones that African wild dogs, they need a lot of protected space to range. They have bigger ranges, but mm-hmm. wild space, connected wild space. So, you know, when you're talking about birds, it's the canopy. They need like a corridor, a green corridor to mm-hmm. traverse these spaces that we humans have basically kind of cut up all space on our planet and dissected it with farms and fences and housing developments. And so wildlife can't cross from A to B, and they need to do that so they can exchange genetic information. And without that, populations become essentially inbred and cannot survive long term. So that's why corridors are so important, and why connecting wild space is super important. Yeah. And the vision for our land, so now it's a nature reserve. It's 3,200 acres, which is about 1,200 hectares. And I like to give people a frame of reference. That's like four times Central Park. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in a way it's big, but in the grand scheme of things, it's kind of relatively small. But why it's so important is that it acts as a corridor. So this land that we've protected and stopped from being destroyed and joined together with neighbors and opened up wild space, it lies between two very big existing wildlife reserves. One side is the Manyuana. It's a home to a very well-known wildlife reserve called Pinda Private Game Reserve. They're amazing when it comes to conservation. They're home to one of the most important cheetah breeding sites in South Africa. They're doing a really good job. They are WWF Black Rhino Range Expansion site. So that means they're so good at keeping their rhinos safe that they actually, their black rhinos, which are critically endangered, they've, increased in number so much so that they could give those rhinos to other reserves where they were lost and start to repopulate
Wow.
black rhinos in other reserves in Africa. They recently actually sent giraffe with the to I think Malawi to help repopulate giraffe there. So they're doing an incredible job keeping wildlife safe and being able to help, other places. And then on the other side of the land where that connects, A to B as a corridor is the UNESCO World Heritage Isimangaliso Wetland Park. I mean, its name in Zulu means a place of wonder. It is a natural wonder, of global significance. That's incredible. It's got the biggest hippo pod in the breeding pod in South Africa, over 500 bird species. And this corridor, it will open up. So our long-term vision is dropping fences on both sides so that wildlife from Pinda, the reserve inland, the elephants, the rhinos can actually traverse through our corridor to Isimangaliso and it goes all the way to the ocean. So, eons ago, the wildlife in South Africa also used to migrate. The wildebeest would migrate through there. This will create a path for wildlife to move again. And that's incredibly important in coming decades with climate change, where wildlife will be stressed. The conditions where they are will change. They need water. They'll move to they need to be able to move to find water and resources. So, yeah, we're excited. That's our big, big vision. And that's why this land is so important. I've shocked you again, Isolde.
Yes, no, yes and no. I'm actually just full of sitting here going, I'm so grateful you're doing the work you're doing, because yeah, I mean, without a way to move where they need to move in order to survive and, dare I say, thrive, they
Yes.
will die. It's that simple. Eventually they will die. So I'm grateful. That was the word that was coming to mind as I was listening to you talk. And this corridor is going to is and is going to be something that allows for that movement. But then you mentioned something earlier that I wanted to touch on. You said the word rewilding, and what that the stuff that you the things that you've been talking about up to now have been about the animals that are already out in the wild. Is rewilding something different than that? And if so, what is it, and how does it impact that notion of habitat protection?
That's a great question. So, rewilding, I have to say, is probably what I love most about what we do. It's so hopeful. So, and it can mean a lot of different things. It could mean bringing back, to some people, rewilding may be, mean bringing back long extinct animals. I mean, what we're doing is so we save the land, we protect it, we start restoring it, and a lot of animals will make their way back naturally. But there's some bigger, usually the larger species that, they're not just going to arrive, there's still fences. So we have to literally reintroduce them. So our rewilding is really the reintroduction of native wildlife that would have existed there before but has, been gone for some time. So it's super exciting. I know when we save the land, the first piece, one of our donors loves giraffe, and that was her first question, when can we get giraffe? And all of this is guided by ecologists and science. And yeah, we reintroduced giraffe for the first time in 2017. It was super exciting, to see them arrive, jump out of a truck and like literally run for it. I can imagine it's quite stressful to be in a truck. They're
Sure.
wild giraffe, and then running free on their new home. And it's so powerful. It's such an inspiring image or thing to witness. And also for our donors to see what we did. I like to say rewilding kind of sells itself. We needed to do it. We needed to get this wildlife. And it's very strange for most of us that in South Africa, you need to buy, usually those animals, you would have to buy them, which is seems so strange to us. Like, what do you mean you can buy a giraffe? And how much is a giraffe? And what do you mean you can buy a zebra? And I think zebra are absolutely incredible. And the idea that there is sort of a market price, $350 per zebra, just seems so cheap. So, when our donors and supporters heard that, they're like, well, I'll buy a zebra. And so that was a really cool connection for them and for us as well to, help fund our rewilding work. It really funded itself. And every person who donated to help us literally purchase an individual zebra, an individual giraffe, they had the chance to name them. And you can tell the difference. Giraffe and zebra, their patterns are unique, like a fingerprint. So we have ID'd all of our giraffe. We have a giraffe ID kit. It's like playing Spot the Difference, looking at their patterns and figuring out who is who. So yeah, we have 14, actually 15 resident giraffe now and over 30 zebra. Every year now we have babies born, which again is proof of this concept. If you can save land and join it with neighboring areas and reintroduce wildlife, nature will then start taking care of itself. And we're seeing zebra foals being born. And huge moment for us was our first baby giraffe being born, on this land that would have otherwise been pineapple. So rewilding, it really is a mix of ecological restoration and then reintroduction of wildlife. And that's what we mean when we say rewilding.
Okay, first of all, I want to help buy a zebra.
You
Can I
want a
do that?
zebra?
Yes, or a giraffe, or a cheetah, or whatever it is whatever it is, because yes, I will actually, that will be my birthday fundraiser this year. I'm gonna tell people that I want to raise money so that I can buy like two giraffe and have them be rewilded in the wild tomorrow. No, seriously, because this is one of those things where that's not something I've ever thought about or known was even possible. And so again, lots of gratitude from my end because it's a way for people like me who probably are never going to start their own Wild Tomorrow Fund to participate in a way that you would find helpful. And that brings me to my next question. What sort of help does the Wild Tomorrow Fund need from people, private citizens, someone who's listening to this podcast who gets fired up like I am now, who wants to help? What kind of help do you need?
Well, we would love help. We still, as I mentioned, that first piece of land, we still have a deadline to meet a fundraising goal to actually finish the purchase. That's in next May. So we love to equate things down to kind of bite-sized chunks. 1 acre is about $990. So if anyone wants to sponsor an acre, it's an amazing gift or a legacy kind of gift to someone. Then we have also volunteer trips, and I think it's super powerful for those who can and would love to join us in the field in South Africa, perhaps next year. We have volunteer trips, so we bring 10 people at a time over to South Africa for 2 weeks, and then you can be individually a part of everything we're doing and see the region and see the wildlife and participate hands-on. It's really kind of for those who where conservation isn't going to be their full-time job, you can, be a part of conservation truly for those weeks. And it's really powerful. I mean, it changes people's lives. That's how, in a way, how we started Wild Tomorrow Fund was John had been volunteering in Zululand, in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. So it really changes people's lives. And we find volunteers come back to New York and they don't want to just, that's it. Thanks, I had a great holiday. They really continue on with us as supporters and keep helping. So yeah, we would love more support and funding and help. And I love that for a lot of our supporters, it's very personal. They really feel a part of what we're doing. And what I find is truly beautiful for those who sponsored wildlife reintroductions, it's really interesting to see what they named their animal. Often it's a pet. So there's a lot of dogs that are, running around in Central Park who have a namesake in Africa. But sometimes it's departed even people, which I think is very moving. That idea that they've created a gift in their name that's now a zebra running free. So yeah, we would love more help.
Ah, that's fantastic. I sign me up. I'm absolutely going to do that. And it's interesting because the words that are coming up in my head as I'm hearing you talk are hope
Yes.
and connection.
Yes.
That you feel connected to this place in South Africa. If you're in New York, if you're in LA, if you're in London, if you're in wherever, and you can actually make that connection. What do you think makes those two words? And maybe I'm totally off, but what makes hope and connection so important in wildlife conservation and habitat restoration and the work that you're doing?
I think it's sort of everything. We started out as well, it being overwhelmed by the destruction. It's easy to get depressed and feel down, thinking about the planet and, this mass loss of biodiversity. It's called the mass extinction, the sixth mass extinction of life on Earth, and this time it's driven by us, not by an asteroid. Climate change, all that grief, like that. I think that sadness does help motivate people to do something, but it can also be really overwhelming. And I think what's important about hope is people need hope. I think we've seen it, all the messaging about climate change. I don't think it's the negative messaging, the warnings, it's really important, but I don't think it's moved people enough. I think we all need to see that we can do something, that your input, that your, everyone feels very small. We're like a drop in the ocean of these global challenges, but actually, you can really make a difference. And if it's one zebra or coming on a volunteer trip, each volunteer raises $2,000. That's 2 acres. You can you, it makes a real difference. And I think people feel inspired by that hope. And in some ways, our project's far away from most people. They're in New York, but that connection and feeling connected to the project, to the land, to those zebras is really important. And that dream that maybe one day they'll be able to come and see for themselves. I think it's really powerful and more positive. I think we've all had a rough year, and yeah, I just think that it's a more positive and powerful message to move people to take action.
Again, I'm thinking. Wow. Yeah, it is true. The world has had a rough year, and yet what's interesting to me about that is that during that time when we were all, as many of us as could be, sort of staying at home, things came back. The weather changed, wildlife started, there were pictures of wildlife on, sort of different critters resting and relaxing in what were normally parks and places where you would just not expect to see wildlife. So there's this the notion that I always come back to, honestly, was they were here first. And so for me, it's not just us making room for them. It's us. I had Captain Paul Watson on my show, just on the show, just a little while ago, and he was saying, one of the things that bothers him is the word stewardship. He doesn't think that stewardship is the way it should go. He's like, we belong here. We're part of it. We're not overseers. We don't have dominion. We're part of this whole entire cycle and process. And so with the work that you're doing, it seems to me like that kind of connection goes beyond people feeling connected. It's a connection to the biome. It's a connection then to the earth. And if you can, do you have any stories of that kind of realization or that kind of moment of truth, if you will, for either from yourself or from your husband or from people that you've worked with?
I just think, while I think about that, it does, I think, bring us back to the concept of rewilding. And another way of thinking about rewilding is rewilding ourselves, meaning reconnecting humans to nature. And exactly like you were saying, and Captain Paul Watson, kind of a paradigm shift from seeing ourselves as having dominion and, power over nature, to being a part of nature, more of a ecocentric approach, and restoring kind of the whole ecosystem. And that includes us too.
Sure.
And repairing that connection between ourselves, to care more about nature, and to give, I see it as giving space back to nature, to birth, they belong equally as we do. We've taken so much away that they need, we need to give space back or we'll lose them all. I think about with this heat wave and just the little things, the birds that died from it was too hot, and I feel that's all, we've caused that with our agriculture and our emissions and how, climate change links back to biodiversity loss. It's all accelerating. So we really need to act now or we will lose. I think how devastating to not have elephants on the planet. How will you explain that to your children? How do people explain that the animals that they grew up with in their storybooks don't exist anymore because we didn't care enough? So I think rewilding the human spirit is a big part of it. For me, I think it came in steps, like rather than kind of a sudden aha moment, more of a build up and a realization. And yeah, I think going from helplessness to empowerment, and knowing it's possible to restore some of the damage we've done, and actually, having this vision for the planet that's 50% for nature. That's a big goal. But I think the more you are in nature, the more you appreciate it. And so I would say, and I think COVID, a lot of people spent time in parks and nature because it was such a relief and a welcome respite for us. And I hope that one of the positive benefits of that is more of a love of nature and then desire to protect it. So I'm hoping.
Hope seems to be the word of the day here. And it's interesting because I know for myself, when we were during lockdown, one of the things that I needed to do was feel the sun on my face. Like I couldn't just sit in the house. So I had to be out and as it even if it were just to walk outside, there was a tree right near our apartment, and I would walk outside and I would say hello to the tree because it gave me that sense of connection. And that's one of the things that it takes us back to ancient stories when people were really part, like knew that they were part of nature, part of the earth, part of a process of this whole biosphere. And it sounds to me like your mission, in part at least, is that in addition to stemming biodiversity loss, is it's kind of, have you found that that's an outcome that the people who are involved really get connected on that deep level
Yeah, and I
back to something like that?
people who maybe weren't really into nature or conservation before have, come on this journey with us and then become essentially conservationists, at heart. I think that's really powerful. I mean, one of our major donors and on the board, initially he was thinking he would spend his philanthropic time on helping with poverty, which is of course a really important topic, but it was his dog, like he had a really strong connection with his pet that made him think more about wildlife. And he went on safari and his wife sort of, he was like, maybe you should think about how, working with Wild Tomorrow Fund. And he's been super helpful or transformative for us and the connections that he's brought. And I think about that he wasn't someone who thought that wildlife and habitat conservation was sort of his thing. We need to find more of those people where it's, it's education and exposure, or, being a part of this project is very inspiring. And then people get sort of caught up in it, which is great. I think we need more people to connect to nature. And is it through, I think it can be through your pet, through that sort of very personal connection between a human and an animal, and seeing them as maybe as an individual and important, and then maybe through the park and appreciating the trees and what they bring for us. And then that kind of connection expands from local to more global issues. So yeah, we need to figure, and I, it's a question I've thought about a lot. How, why do I care so deeply, which, has been a progression over time, to the point that I would give up, sort of dedicate my life to this and saving nature. And then other people, you know, they're maybe distracted or they don't care as much. How do you convert? I want to say convert. How do you inspire other people to connect more deeply to nature? So that's a big question. And I think being out in nature is the key, and going for those hikes or coming on a trip to South Africa, of course, super powerful, and helping out with conservation, really being involved. And I think it really grows from there.
Yeah, I know. Poor Wendy, you're going. Is she still there? I'm not sure what's going on. I'm sorry. As you were speaking, I was there again. I had my little metaphoric pom-poms out and I was cheering you on. And it's when I used, as I said, I used to work for NASA and I used to do these participate in these environmental education workshops where we traveled all over the world. And one of the places we traveled was South Africa.
Oh, fantastic.
And did a workshop, and the people who came were all teachers and other educators, and who were going to be learning about these environmental protocols so that their students could study local ecosystems. And so when you were asking that question, I'm like, yeah, I do this thing called the Earth Lady, where I go into schools and I teach about the soil and the atmosphere and the water bodies and the biosphere as far as like the plants that grow on near their school so that they can get into it. And now I'm like, okay, I need to obviously add an animal component. What are the animals in your local area, and what kind of wildlife is there? What might you find? And it translates up into what's out in South Africa, what's out in Namibia, what's in Central Asia. There are lots of places where we can be looking at this. And so the question that I have for you about that is, if you could have anything you wanted for Wild Tomorrow Fund to do, what would be the vision? What is the big, this is what would look like it was doing what we had dreamed of.
Oh, it's a big question.
I don't ask small questions.
I can see, if I think 10 years ahead, or maybe, we'll be, we've done a lot more than we thought we could in a short amount of time. So maybe 5 years ahead, this corridor project in South Africa is really the first. So the dream is for that to be completed. The corridor is open and working as a corridor for wildlife, connecting these two huge reserves together, 80,000 acres to 800,000 acres, and
Wow.
connecting that green space, and the elephants can migrate again, and wildebeest, that will be like a really huge achievement and a dream come true. And then, of course, it's ongoing. It's like then the reserve, the vision is for it to be self-sustaining. And then the question is, what's next? So, I see this future where we have, our, it's called the Ukwela Nature Reserve in South Africa, then other places on the planet that are threatened and at immediate risk of destruction and conversion for, agricultural development, where there's really threatened species, and saving that land and kind of repeating the process to save it, protect it, restore it, rewild it. I mean, it could be Madagascar. It could be, I read about a place in Philadelphia that's super important habitat for fireflies, and without this habitat, this incredible spectacle won't exist. So I think a project in the United States would be incredible. Just being able to show what's possible with re restoration rewilding, that would be my dream and big goal.
I love it to show what's possible with restoration. I think that's great. So, first of all, Wendy, you're not getting rid of me that easily. I'm so totally going to start getting people to sponsor zebras and giraffes. That's going to be
For your
wonderful.
birthday fundraiser.
Absolutely. I'm gonna see what I can do. And I also believe in starting them while they're young, so we're gonna get kids on board.
We had some kindergartners did some made some slime and sold slime and raised, like, I think it was $400. So I
Amazing.
don't know, people who little big, it's really amazing what people can do when they really want to. So yeah.
And also, I mean, one of the things that I've sort of really learned in this last hour of chatting with you is that there are things I didn't know were possible. And so now that I know that they're possible, and now that if you're listening to this episode, now that you know they're possible, the call has been made take up the banner and get Rangers shoes or something like that, or sponsor a zebra. I think that those are the kinds of things that we can be doing that I didn't realize that it could be done. So I'm really grateful to you, Wendy, for sharing all of this. And if someone wants to get involved, how do they find you? Where can they find out about the Wild Tomorrow Fund to get involved, to sponsor a zebra, to name the zebra? I would name a zebra Kimba after my beloved cat. I know that I would, but how would they do that?
Okay, well, for them to get in touch or find out more about what we do, they can head to our website, which is wildtomorrowfund.org. You'll see there's stories and also a volunteer menu, so you can look at, you know, what trips we have coming up. Our animal sponsorships are more sort of direct because we have to be actually sort of reintroducing more, or actually each year we have zebra born, for example. So you can actually sponsor a baby zebra instead of, you know, we're actually not needing to purchase some right now because they're kind of rewilding themselves. There will come a time where we need to purchase more wildlife. So there is a contact us on the website at the bottom, and that email will come to me and to John, and we'd love to be in touch. And we love it. A lot of our supporters say when they talk about the work of Wild Tomorrow Fund, they say, we did this. So it really, truly is a community. It's very personal. I like to say as well, there's one degree of separation between, you know, you, the donor, and the field, because there is this sort of between here. And then, we're, you know, in a way, we're a very small team doing big things, and we're really proud of what we've been able to do. And so it is quite personal. And we love meeting new people. We need to meet new people. So please reach out. We'd love to hear from you. And everybody can help, from a kindergartner to a high school kid to, you know, a retiree. So please, we need more people to help the planet. So hope you'll join us.
Yay. Absolutely. Well, I'm going to put all of that information in the show notes. And Wendy, I know that you have to run, but I do have one question that I ask everybody who comes on the show. And it's a silly question, but I find that it yields some very interesting results. And the question is this: if you had an airplane that could skywrite anything for the whole world to see, what would you say?
Ooh, that's an awesome question. I would say, love nature. I don't know. It's about moving people to really care. So rewild your heart, something like that. And then people have to think, what does that mean? And then go actually read, what does rewilding mean? And come on board with us. So rewild, maybe just rewild and leave it rewild. Ambiguous. And then people have to be like, what on earth does that mean?
And so you do rewild at wildtomorrowfund.org, right? So, wonderful. That's right. Absolutely. Well, Wendy, thank you so much. What a phenomenal conversation. I'm so grateful that you were on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much, Isolde, for having me and giving us this opportunity to tell the story of Wild Tomorrow Fund and rewilding to all your listeners. It was such a pleasure, and thank you so much.
My pleasure. If you've listened to this episode, go get involved with Wild Tomorrow Fund. Find a way to volunteer, find a way to sponsor a baby zebra. How could you not want to sponsor a baby zebra? Come on. This is Isolde Trachtenberg for the Innovative Mindset Podcast, reminding you to listen, learn, laugh, and love a whole lot. Thanks so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you being here. Please subscribe to the podcast if you're new. And if you like what you're hearing, please review it and rate it and let other people know. And if you'd like to be a sponsor of the show, I'd love to meet you on patreon.com/innovativemindset. I also have lots of exclusive goodies to share just with the show's supporters there. Today's episode was produced by Isolde Trachtenberg and is copyright 2021. As always, please remember this is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results, although we can always hope. Until next time, keep living in your innovative mindset.